Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. If I sound a little bit different, it's because I am in LA where it's about zero dark 30, talking with Josh Crashour, three time zones away. So good morning. Welcome back to the podcast, Josh.
Good morning, Charlie. Great to be back.
So, you know, when you fly, I haven't flown a lot in the last year and a half. I mean, I have flown, but I have been kind of quarantined. So maybe I've led a sheltered life. So it was kind of an interesting experience getting on the airplane and figuring out that before takeoff, you had to load your credit card into some app because the only way you would be able to buy any, you know, alcohol or anything was touchless. Have you done this? It's touchless. They won't even touch your credit card anymore.
Yeah, I've only flown once since the pandemic, and it was not a pleasant experience. Or I sympathize with the flight attendants and the pilots.
Yeah, no. Everybody was great.
The planes are packed. People are upset, and everyone's worried about, you know, the pandemic. So it's,
I did this, but it was the, you know, putting in your mailing address about 10 times.
And you don't get internet service. I tried that, and I didn't get, you know, an internet connection. So I was frustrated to no end when I tried to do it.
Well, the other big dilemma, of course, is like, what do you do on the flight? Everyone experiences this. There are more choices now, obviously, you know, the movies and television, and there's always books, and you could listen to a podcast. I didn't have to make any of those choices. I did tweet about this because, as I said, I've led apparently a sheltered life because the couple behind me was arguing so loudly that I had to turn everything off. Possibly alcohol was involved in this. But the wife is really, really, really angry because she really hates her father-in-law. And she's going on about how terrible her father-in-law is, how insulting. You know, he's a know-it-all. And he treats her like crap all the time. And they always visit his family, and they don't visit her family. And he's trying to, you know, he's not so bad. Well, he just, and she's getting, you know, I went to bed really pissed last night, she said, and you didn't even know. Mumble, mumble, mumble. It's because you become so desensitized about what a bleep hole your father is. And so I'm starting to make notes on this, because where is this actually going to go? And so at one point she says, "Well, I am finished with this." And then, of course, we were landing in Denver, and I had to, you know, put my seat up in its full upright and locked position, as well as the tray table, etc. You know, but it actually gets better because I get out of the plane, and the couple that was sitting across from me, you know, in the jetway, are saying, "Well, at least that was an entertaining flight, and it was free. The entertainment was free." And I said, "Did you hear that too?" And they go, "Yeah. We turned off the movie. We were watching a movie, and we turned it off." And the guy said, "Yeah, I didn't really know what was happening until she started punching him."
Oh goodness!
I missed the punching because they were directly behind me. So anyway, that's kind of my adventure, Josh.
My two creature comforts on planes. Noise canceling headphones and high speed internet or fast internet on the plane. I get those two things. I'm fine.
Be happy. And an IPA. Just that would be the one. That would be the one thing. Okay, so we have a lot to talk about today in terms of what the former guy is saying. I'm gonna work up to that. Did you hear this? This is a couple days old, but I still think it's an extraordinary moment. Lindsey Graham speaking to Republicans in South Carolina. I know you've probably read about this, but here's Lindsey Graham, who's constantly trying to figure out who he is and who's going to love him. And he's speaking to a group of fellow Republicans in South Carolina. And I want to make this clear up front. He's doing the right thing, but the reaction is really still so revealing and extraordinary. So let's play a little soundbite of Lindsey Graham meeting the folks in South Carolina.
If you haven't had the vaccine, you ought to think about getting it, because if you're my age, I didn't tell you to get it, you ought to think about it.
Just think about it.
I'm glad I got it. 92% of the people in the hospitals in South Carolina are unvaccinated.
He's like, "I'm not telling you to get the vaccine. I'm just telling you to think about it." No. Josh, this is kind of an illustration of the leopards eating people's faces party, isn't it? It's like
and it also reminds me of what we heard yesterday at the Facebook congressional hearing, where the types of misinformation, the types of engaging posts often jibe with what those protesters or what those booing attendees at Lindsey Graham's town hall are reading and sucking up on a daily basis. You know, we've always had fringes in American politics, but they've never seemed so loud, so empowered, so emboldened. And, you know, you're right. Trump has fueled that, especially, you know, among Republicans. But you can't win. Even Trump not having access to social media since his presidency hasn't changed that fundamental dynamic that people are getting bad information, bad, inaccurate news. It's not news. And that's getting worse and worse and worse.
It's not just the bad information. They have feelings and they're angry all the time. So Lindsey Graham says, I'm not telling you to get the vaccine. I'm just telling you to think about it. No, we're not going to think. Don't you tell us what to think about. I mean, whoa, these are people's grandparents, Josh. I mean,
what's interesting is that every cultural or every societal issue has become a political football. You have to argue over everything. And I don't know if you caught this, Charlie, but Ron Johnson was on Fox this week. And I was actually kind of wondering whether the pill that may be released that can cure the symptoms from the COVID, if that's going to be the same type of tribal issue, or if that's maybe the pill versus the shot maybe be helpful to get people cured and treated. But Ron Johnson was on Fox this week, and he said that the Merck, the company that produced the pill, stole the information about the treatment from Ivermectin, the other controversial drug that's not particularly effective. Because that's the drug that Republican, very conservative right wing Republicans are talking about, right? So I don't think we're over. This is just the tip of the iceberg, Charlie. Like, everything has become politicized. Everything has become tribal, and we can't even have fundamental agreements on common sense issues.
It's one thing to blame Facebook, and I am willing to pile on Facebook. Don't get me wrong. But when you have United States senators spewing bullshit, this is again, how bad is the situation? It's bad. It's really bad, because even if you try to tell people reasonable things like Lindsey Graham, you know, he's going to get booed. And then you have Ron Johnson, who's on Fox News, spreading these absolutely baseless conspiracy theories. You know, it's as if, you know, he was sitting around thinking, I haven't said anything crazy this week. What can I say that's like, you know, completely crazy? And he does. And of course, there's no consequences. I mean, he's not going to not be invited back on Fox News, right? Nobody was yelling at him. Okay, so I'm already just, you know, kind of.
Well, and let me just add to that, Charlie. The bidding war gets higher and higher.
Yes, right, like, exactly.
Right, and I don't know if you followed Josh Mandel's Twitter feed, the Senate candidate in Ohio, but he seems to have to get more and more extreme as the mainstream right moves in that direction.
It's
right,
drugs. It's drugs. You need to have the more potent meth on the streets.
Yep. I mean, that's a great comparison, because it gets more outrageous and more outrageous, and we all get numb to it, because it's just becoming so commonplace.
So what was Josh Mandel's latest tweet? What he's basically now celebrating January 6th, like, you know, how wonderful it is that children went there, and because this was democracy or something like that.
Someone took his daughter to the rally, and this is the paragon of democracy. It's the example of democracy in action.
Well, I want to come back to this, but I'm on this issue of you know, people's feelings getting ramped up, because, you know, it seems like an old and tired debate to say we should have more civility in our politics. Well, yes, we should. But as I wrote in my newsletter this morning, civility is having a really, really bad week, you know, following senators into the ladies' room. And you have parents who are protesting outside the home, the private residence of a school board member, because of a mask policy. You know, you come out. We want to confront you with our demands. It's like everybody is cranked up to a level of 10 all the time. And that's what makes this scary. It's not just that it's out there. It's not just that we're divided. It's that the anger and outrage is being stoked. And then it's being rationalized so that if you really feel intensely about it, you feel that you have permission to engage in any kind of conduct, no matter what. And anybody that says, hey, you know what, I understand you're frustrated, I understand you're irritated, but perhaps you ought not to engage in performative assholery. No, because my feelings are really, really, really intense. And I'm sorry, it's like, okay, here we go. So speaking of misinformation, you heard about the former guy who went on the John Solomon podcast. John Solomon was one of these Ukraine gate reporters, right? One of the people who was trying to smear, you know, various people. How do you describe John Solomon?
Well, John Solomon used to be an investigative reporter at the Washington Post. It's kind of bizarre to see how his career has ended up. But yeah, like he used to be someone who was, you know, on the front page of the paper every morning in the Post. And now he's, you know, kind of a crank.
He's kind of a crank. Well, but he's a crank with a podcast, I suppose. See, this is the thing. It's like, hey, this podcasting is really cool. Look at all of these cranks, you know. So he gets the former president of the United States to come on his podcast, and we have a new form of retconning, a new revisionist history. You can tell that Donald Trump is working on the marketing message for the Great Revenge Tour of 2024, right? He's going to run again. And, you know, obviously he wants to run on the big lie, and he's figuring out ways to recast his attempts to overthrow the election. Because even in the modern Republican Party, even in 2021, there are people who think that a president trying to overthrow a legitimate election is a little bit questionable, right? So he recognizes that he has to deal with this. So here's the latest version of this. This is the former president of the United States on this cranky podcast yesterday.
The insurrection took place on November 3rd. That was the insurrection when they rigged the election. The big insurrection, the real insurrection, really the crime of the century. Yeah. That took place on November 3rd, not on January 6th.
They're dropping subpoena on all of your former advisors. Do you plan to invoke executive privilege? Do you plan to fight some of these requests?
We did nothing wrong. They did something wrong. The investigation should be on the election of November 3rd, on the presidential election of 2020. That's what the committee should be set up for. And they should investigate the election fraud because many states had fraud, many states. Many people that you know got two ballots, three ballots, four ballots.
Yes.
The most I heard was seven, but they got a lot of ballots. The post office, the delivery, sometimes they get delivered, sometimes they don't. It is the greatest, I'm telling you, it is the greatest fraud ever committed in this country, probably, but it is the crime of the century.
The crime of the century, Josh Krasshauer. So here's the new narrative. The real insurrection was the election. It wasn't the attempt to overthrow the election. The election itself was the crime. So the entire Democratic process is illegitimate, and he's going to ride that to the Republican nomination. So I mean, look, that it's overwhelmingly probable that he'll use that in the campaign. It's an absolute certainty. He'll use it to fleece his supporters. I mean, this is the great thing. This is the big lie has become the great grift, hasn't it? I mean, he will raise hundreds of millions of dollars off that.
Well, it's worse than that, Charlie, because it's now the litmus test for Republican candidates in a lot of these primaries for Congress, right? So you're now seeing, you mentioned Josh Mandel in Ohio, who's the at least right now, though, the front runner in that Senate race, a race that leans Republican, a state that leans Republican, at least. You have, you know, Alabama, Mo Brooks. You've got Georgia and Arizona. These are must-win Senate races in purple states where you got Herschel Walker, who endorses a lot of the same stuff. And you got a Republican. You can't even the popular governor of Arizona, a Republican, Doug Ducey, can't run because he doesn't want to engage in this kind of silliness. It is... It's to the point where Donald Trump has a rally in Georgia a couple of weeks ago, and he hates Governor Brian Kemp so much that he all but endorsed Stacey Abrams, and yet conservative talk show hosts can't say anything. Can't, even though they think what he said is crazy and they don't agree with it, they're stunned into silence because Trump has such a hold on the Republican Party electorate.
Strategic silence. We'll just wait for something else to come up. Okay, so deep breath here. I don't want to obsess over the debt ceiling or others. We've talked about this before. So here's my question, Josh. Is with all this back and forth going on, you know, high drama in D.C., is anybody outside of D.C., do average voters actually care about all of this? I mean, every once in a while, we have to step back and realize that the process is inside baseball, and the only thing that really matters is the result. But process can still do some damage, can't it? So give me some sense. Is anybody actually paying attention to this, or will they just wait until it crashes and go, hey, what just happened to my 401k?
Right. Well, I bet if you asked most Hill reporters covering the debt ceiling, most of them don't understand all the machinations about what's going on behind the scenes. I mean, they get the big picture, but this is so dense, so esoteric. In fact, the Morning Consult did a poll and asked about the debt ceiling, and most people didn't really know what was going on.
Right.
So you are right, Charlie, that this is outcome based. If there is a default, if there's a crisis, obviously voters are going to be paying attention. But I think a lot of this is inside baseball maneuvering. I don't, Moody's, a lot of the credit agencies don't see a default, because ultimately we've played this game before. It's a game of cat and mouse between the parties, and ultimately there's going to be movement at the very end. And I see it very unlikely that there's going to be a crisis. And I think voters intuitively expect that because of past experience.
Yeah, I mean it's sort of this Byzantine, back and forth, and then in the end, there's white smoke that comes out of the Capitol, and everything's okay. So I want to talk about Kyrsten Sinema, because speaking of people who are inspiring passions, I got a direct message. I should never read direct messages, but this one was pretty good. It was one of the first things I saw when I got here to LA. Say, keep in mind that Kyrsten Sinema is a Democratic senator. She is one of the 50. You don't have a majority without Kyrsten Sinema. She has voted with the Biden administration, nearly 90% of the time. Obviously, she's playing some games with reconciliation. We can talk about that in a moment. Okay, so I got this direct message. Sinema, one of the best politicians, ? Are you out of your mind? Why? Because she wants to stop the infrastructure bill? You are still a solid Republican. What a shame. I am unfollowing you. And so I don't know, because I had some time, I said, when did I ever say that? And he goes, no. You liked a tweet that said this. What I did was, Matt Lewis, who is trolling everybody in the world, did a column yesterday where he said that Kyrsten Sinema and Liz Cheney may be the bravest politicians in America. It was a column designed to piss everybody off, right? So I retweeted it saying, Matt is just trolling everybody now, right? So because I retweeted that tweet, the guy says, well, I am unfollowing you, which gives you an insight into the passions that Kyrsten Sinema can inspire. Okay, let's talk about Kyrsten.
Really think about this on as far as just the policy side of what Sinema supports. She voted for the $1.9 trillion in stimulus, right?
And if she had not, it wouldn't have passed. Just remind people.
Well, that's $1.9 trillion right there, right? Yeah. She co-wrote or helped negotiate a little over $1 trillion in infrastructure money that was part of the compromise that Republicans and Democrats struck. So that's about $3 trillion. And she does support social spending, just not at the $3.5 trillion level. She's more in the $1.5 trillion space. So that's another $1.5 trillion. She supports $4.5 trillion in additional spending. That used to be controversial, even in moderate Democratic circles, not that long ago. And yet, because she's not willing to spend another $3 trillion, she's a traitor. She is, you're talking about you just see the videos of people I've never seen this, like just taping her in bathrooms and following her around planes. It's ridiculous. And she is not a conservative. Moderate is a good way of putting it these days, but her position 10 years ago under President Obama would have put her, in the center left of the Democratic Party back then. The notion that she is somehow a traitor and somehow the worst person in the world shows just how far the Democratic Party has moved to the left, how Bernie Sanders has really kind of won out the debate on policy within the Democratic Party, while folks like Sinema and Manchin and other quieter Senate Democrats who don't want to stick their neck out for fear of having the same anger at them as Sinema's been facing, they're now in the minority. They're now finding themselves overmatched and outnumbered.
Let's talk about Kyrsten Sinema, because she's getting an interesting treatment. The New York Times, of course, has this piece of the cocooning of Kyrsten Sinema by Reed Epstein that I would say, and this may be somewhat unfair, kind of characterizes her as kind of a little bit flaky, that she doesn't talk to people, that she doesn't engage with her constituents, that she's a little bit odd. So you've covered that race. I agree with you, by the way. The whole notion she's not a moderate, she's a conservative, it's ridiculous if you look at her voting right. But what exactly is she? And I guess I'm sorry to put it this way, but you know, there is that this narrative which I find interesting among in the media and among progressives that she's really, really, really flaky, or that she's an evil sellout. So who the hell is she?
I would use the word eccentric. I think one of the most interesting, fascinating, compelling things about Senator Sinema is that she's now a centrist, right? But when she started her political career, she was one of the most left-wing activists you could possibly imagine. She voted for Ralph Nader in 2000. She led some of the most, strange anti-war protests during the Bush years and made a lot of intemperate comments that actually were used against her in that 2018 campaign to the point where I thought she might lose because of her past history.
Yeah, I remember that.
She also was a progressive in the state legislature initially. She was one of the most progressive state lawmakers in Arizona. And at some point when she was in the state legislature, she had sort of a coming of age moment where she realized she wasn't getting anything done. It wasn't helping her political career. And she did a total 180 where she started working more with Republicans to pass legislation to get things done in what was then a pretty Republican state at the time. Now, a lot of Democrats expected her to kind of talk moderate in the campaign, but be a reliable party line vote after being elected. And like you said, Charlie, she has voted ultimately with the Biden administration most of the time. But the notion that, you know, Democrats expect her to support, you know, $3.5 trillion in government spending at a time of inflation, when she represents a state that is very affluent, it has a big suburban core where she actually made huge political inroads in her own election. The notion that like playing progressive politics in Arizona is a winning strategy is purely delusional. And she understands the politics of Arizona. She understands that you need to be moderate to win in a state like that. And she understands that her strategy is a little risky, but I think it's very logical. She's spending political capital on the left 3 years before her election in order to brand herself as a maverick, brand herself as someone who's going to stick the middle finger at these left-wingers in Congress. And that's going to give her invaluable goodwill when she's up for re-election. And frankly, I honestly don't think people are going to remember all the details of the, you know, especially if something passes ultimately. Democrats are going to challenge her.
How is this in fact playing back in Arizona? I mean, you've written about this. Have there been polls? How is it playing back home?
Yeah, I mean, she has lost support with Democrats in Arizona. It depends on what poll you look at, but she still has about, you know, 50%+ support among Democrats. But most Democrats have 80-90% support within their party. Mm-hmm. At this moment, she's, you know, kind of down to the 50s, 60s in one other poll. She's doing well with independents. She, in one poll, shows her doing better than Mark Kelly, the junior senator who also won a close race this past year.
Who is actually up for re-election next year.
And she's helping him out. I think she's helping him out by distracting scrutiny from Senator Kelly and putting it squarely on herself, even though she doesn't have an election until 2024. So she's doing well with independents. Not amazingly well, but she's definitely bought some political capital with independent voters. And she's doing remarkably well with Republicans. She's at the very least tamped down the opposition from Republicans. About 40% of Republicans view her favorably. Now, she's not going to be in a campaign that those numbers are not going to last. She's not going to have 40% support from Republicans. But she only needs about 10% support from Republicans. She got 12% in her 2018 election, which was a very unusually high number in and of itself. So this is building her goodwill across the aisle, which I think is going to be long lasting.
Okay, you're making an interesting point here. She is eccentric. She's probably a little bit strange. There's no question about it. I mean, I'm some of the criticisms have some validity, but what I hear you saying is that if you watched the way she ran and the way she positioned herself when she was campaigning, it pretty much tracks with the kind of senator she's being, that people shouldn't be surprised that she's kind of centrist, mavericky, unpredictable.
She called herself an Arizona independent continuously during that 2018 campaign. And she was running, by the way, against Martha McSally, who at the time was seen as a very good Republican recruit. Now, she did not run a good campaign, and she had a lot of problems of her own. But look at Arizona, Charlie. the Republican Party has been taken over by Trumpists. The party is a mess, the Republican Party in Arizona.
And the craziest brand of Trumpist as well.
Absolutely. Just look at this election audit. I mean, it's crazy, right? Sinema sees the opportunity that Republicans are giving Democrats, but they will lose that opportunity if they end up embracing the crazy on their own side. So she's got this wide open middle that she's embracing, and they're embracing her back. And, you know, the results speak for themselves. She won very narrowly in that 2018 election, which was a really good year, a wave year for Democrats. There was a gubernatorial nominee who was running alongside of her who actually ran as a progressive. Adopted the most progressive immigration positions, checked every box for progressives, and got some support, got some money. And it wasn't like he was a fringe candidate. It was a serious candidate running as the first Hispanic governor to be governor of Arizona. He ran 10, 20 points behind her in a year that was a Democratic wave in Arizona. So that's all you need to know. The progressive model has been tried in Arizona 3 years ago, and it failed spectacularly in the same election year that Kyrsten Sinema pulled off the upset victory.
Okay, but back to the eccentricity. I'm looking at the Reid Epstein piece in the New York Times where he talks about when he was covering her before her election, and he had a 38-minute discussion. And he says that this whole event was seemingly conducted purely for the benefit of the Wall Street Journal, where I worked at the time, and CNN. And she took every opportunity at that time to praise President Donald J. Trump and her meetings with him. When she was asked about childcare, she said Trump's daughter, Ivanka Trump, was working on it. In our subsequent 13-minute interview, Sinema could not name any topics in which she disagreed with Trump. When I asked what her younger self, who worked for Ralph Nader's campaign, would think of her 2018 self, she said her younger self, would be proud of the growth. And she wouldn't say whether she had given up on her former more liberal beliefs, but she stressed she had prioritized results over rhetoric. So this is what puzzles people. It's like, okay, where is she? I mean, it's one thing for her, as you've laid out, to say that she's charting kind of a third way, you know, independence. But what was with the Trump flirtation back in 2018?
So I think that may be a little overstated. If I remember correctly, she did not openly criticize Trump as much as most Democrats did, but there were areas where she did put out statements breaking with the Trump White House. Like, she was not exactly a Democratic Trump supporter. So I think that may have been an outlier. The bigger issue to me when I read Reid Epstein's piece in the Times is that she avoided that was a rare interview that she gave the national media during that campaign. I was out in Arizona. I spent a week in Arizona during that campaign, during the end of the campaign when things were getting really heated. And I had a similar experience as Reid. I didn't get any details about her schedule, whether she was holding any events. I also had a similar experience where right on my way out of town, they told me about an event at the last minute, which I ended up going to. It was a veteran. She was talking to a lot of moderate-minded veterans. And she worked the room really well. This was not a staged event. It was a constituent service type event where she was really working the room. And a lot of these moderate minded McCain Republicans really liked her, spent a long time talking to her after the event was over. But when I stuck my mic out and wanted to ask her kind of the same questions Reid was, she literally ran out the door. Her spokesman kind of body blocked me, and I had to scream some questions as she ran to her SUV. So she does not talk to the press. Yeah. She certainly doesn't talk to the national press. And the difference between her and McCain, she's trying to model herself after John McCain, the maverick of Arizona. But McCain loved the press. He went on every Sunday show. He talked to the press all the time. She did not talk to the national
press. That was his base, right? The media. So what is that about? Why does she not want to talk to the press?
I mean, my view of it at the time was she did not want to confront the history of her evolution. Like, that was my main question.
Too awkward, yeah.
How do you become a Ralph Nader supporter who's leading anti-war protests and then 10 years later, 15 years later, you're now running as this Trump, you're not criticizing Trump and you're running as a centrist in Arizona. Like, it's a fascinating dynamic. It's a fascinating story. And she's quirky. She's got this very interesting personality. She's the first bisexual member of the Senate. There's a lot about her that screams like writing up a profile that will be very, very fascinating and very, very readable. but she did not want to engage. She wanted to do everything through her spokespeople, and she was one of the least transparent candidates I ever covered in a big race like that.
So how do you think this is playing out with her, the vitriol from members of her own party being chased into bathrooms, yelled at on airplanes and in airports? Is this the kind of thing that is likely to persuade her? Is she likely to get her back up? What, do you have any sense? I mean, nobody really seems to know how she goes about making these decisions. But do you think this tactic and this pressure will be effective?
No. I mean, if there's anything we know about her, is that she likes to go against the grain, so to speak. You know, she went against the Democratic establishment in the beginning of her life. She liked to put, and she was a lefty and a Green Party member or a Green Party supporter. And now she's doing it the other way. She
likes being a contrarian. This is a woman that wore a sweater reading "Dangerous Creature," presiding over the United States Senate. Perhaps not the kind of person who's going to be intimidated by, you know, being videotaped on somebody's smartphone, right?
Yeah, it reminds me of the coat. What was it, the coat that Melania Trump wore? I really don't care.
Yeah,
right. I mean, she could wear that coat. That's her philosophy. Yeah. Now, I talked to senators, Democratic senators. Republican Susan Collins, some of the more moderate Republican senators who work with her pretty frequently, and they speak very highly of her behind the scenes. She is popular within a lot of senators, especially Republicans. A lot of Republicans work well with her, and she's not kind of quiet. She does play a constructive role, but publicly to the media, ever since she ran for the Senate, she has been almost all but mum to everyone, maybe with the exception of a couple Arizona reporters she occasionally talks to.
No, I was looking over her voting record, and this is where you're scratching your heads about all of I understand the irritation and the anger. I get it, except that people need to understand that we're talking about a reconciliation bill because that budget resolution passed the Senate 51-50, right? Passed. It would not have passed without Kyrsten Sinema. We wouldn't even be having this discussion without her. You wouldn't have the bipartisan infrastructure bill without Kyrsten Sinema. When it comes to voting rights issues, she is the crucial vote. We hear all of this talk about the need to abolish the filibuster so we can get these important priorities through. None of those important priorities pass without her vote. Not one of them. So, I don't know. So, okay.
Let's get real about the seriousness of a primary challenge, too. Yeah. Because not only is Arizona a moderate state with a lot of moderate independents and Democrats, it's kind of insane to think that Democrats are going to be facing a pretty evenly divided Senate no matter what happens in 2022. It's going to be pretty close, and it's going to be hard for Democrats to hold the Senate majority without winning Senator Sinema's seat, right?
Yeah, no kidding.
The notion that they would get behind a primary challenge that could essentially hand the seat over to Republicans just because of spite over something that happened a few years ago, it seems delusional, frankly. And there have been only two Democratic senators who have lost primaries in the last 30 or so, about since 1992. Joe Lieberman, who ended up winning re-election as an independent, and Arlen Specter, who actually switched parties at the last minute after spending his career as a Republican. So, like, historically and just the political reality of a primary challenge makes very little sense, isn't really plausible, and I think she knows that. She knows that, and she's, that's why she's deliberately moving to the center and sticking the middle finger at the progressives in the state that don't have all that much influence.
Well, also, as you pointed out earlier in the podcast, what matters are the results. So that 2-3 years down the road, if in fact this bill passes with her support, nobody's really going to remember that much about how we got there. Okay, so I want to talk to you about another race that is like right in front of us right now that is going to be I was going to say overanalyzed, but it obviously is going to be an important indicator of the state of politics right now, which is the governor's race in Virginia. And I want to talk to you about that right after this. If you're a fan of this podcast or any of our other podcasts here at The Bulwark, I really think you're going to enjoy our newest edition. It's called The Focus Group, and it's hosted by our own Sarah Longwell. Maybe you've heard Sarah talk about these focus groups that she conducts, but now she's actually sharing real audio from the participants. It's a great show, and I know you're going to love it. Again, it's called The Focus Group with Sarah Longwell, and you can find it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and everywhere else you consume podcasts. Okay, we're back with Josh Krashauer from the National Journal. Josh, you have been writing extensively about the Virginia governor's race. These races, because they're off year, are always kind of seen as harbingers of the national mood. And I think that there had been early on and the kind of the assumption that Virginia had turned blue, that there was a Democratic wave there. Terry McAuliffe is the Democratic candidate. He's being challenged by Glenn Youngkin, who has been trying to, is it fair to say, kind of walk this tightrope of Trumpiness?
So I call Glenn Youngkin a Mitt Romney in a Donald Trump world. He was the former head of the Carlyle Group, which is frankly about as establishment as it gets in Republican.
Yeah, very populist, yeah.
Right. He lives in Great Falls, Virginia, which is probably the richest town in the state. Terry McAuliffe lives right next door in McLean. So these are two really rich, really wealthy establishment type candidates. But Youngkin has been trying to balance the need to get the Trump voters in the rural parts of Virginia out to the polls to get them engaged, while also winning over the suburban voters that voted for Mitt Romney but have defected in the last two elections to Joe Biden and Hillary Clinton. And those are it's a really difficult needle to thread. But he also has, I think a lot of people misinterpreted where Virginia is politically. Virginia has a lot of moderate voters like Arizona. A lot of them left the Republican Party in the last two elections. But these are not progressives. These are not like fire-breathing left wingers, and Virginia is functionally a blue leaning, but still a purple state. And governor's races in Virginia almost always go against the president's party. It's always held the year after the presidential election, and almost to a T in the last like 50 years, the election goes against the party in charge. So Youngkin not only has the political wind at his back fundamentally, but he's also facing the Democrats and facing McAuliffe at a time when the Democratic Party is really, in disarray, is really struggling to come up with a message to get things done in Washington. And this is almost a perfect storm for Republicans, where they have a candidate that's not a Trumpist, even though he's pandered to that wing of the party. And he also has a lot of issues that are playing in his direction. So this is going to be, I've talked to both campaigns in the last couple of days. This is a tied race. This race is in the internal data from the campaigns pretty much neck and neck. And it's going to come down to, it's going to come down. We'll be in for a long night, I think, on election day next month, because this is, and like you note, Charlie, the stakes are pretty high, because if Biden loses, if McAuliffe rather loses in Virginia, the Biden agenda is functionally over. There are going to be Democrats in tough races for next year that are going to be looking at a result in a state like Virginia if Republicans win. And heading for the hills and trying to, batter down and not try to support a whole lot coming from this White House.
Well, let's stick with that point. Okay, so it's a governor's race in one state. Why would that be the end of the Biden agenda?
So number one, Virginia is unusual because the election is held a year after the presidential race. So more than any other governor's race, it really has served as a temperature check for where the politics are. So I'm not someone who sees tea leaves in every election, but Virginia has always been a pretty accurate bellwether of where the politics are in the country. It's had a pretty remarkable streak. In fact, Terry McAuliffe was the only governor to break that streak in the last 40 years when he ran against Ken Cuccinelli in 2013 after Obama got elected, right?
Yeah.
And Cuccinelli only lost by 3 points. It's a pretty close race when everyone thought that McAuliffe was going to win in a landslide. So the wind is very much, the mood of the country, it's a good temperature check.
But how does it actually play out? Does a Republican win in Virginia just spook all of the vulnerable centrist Democrats in Congress just across the country, and they're like, we're off, we're out?
Well, it's not just a win or a loss, but it's also the way McAuliffe has talked about some of the big issues in the race. So, one of the more notable lines he had at the last debate was about, urging Democrats to pass, an infrastructure bill. And he did say that, I believe he thought the $3.5 trillion number was too high.
Right.
Virginia voters, the ones who decide Virginia elections, these are moderate minded voters in Northern Virginia and the Richmond suburbs and Tidewater, who have leaned pretty strongly to the Democratic Party. But Democrats have been renting these voters. These are not, hardcore Democrats. These are persuadable swing voters who probably lean Democrat, but aren't locked in with the party. So, you know, when you have a bad political environment for your party, and then frankly, you know, Youngkin has run on some issues like education that are really resonant in these suburban communities. And like he's been able to tap into like some of this latent anger, latent dissatisfaction that I think McAuliffe has been slow to pick up on.
Okay, so on that, if I'm in Virginia and I'm watching the political commercials, which are often an indicator of like what the candidate thinks is working, what is Youngkin hammering on right now?
Well, right now, actually, it's funny you ask, because he's running an advertising blitz 100% on education. There was a line that McAuliffe used in the last debate a couple weeks ago, saying, basically arguing that parents shouldn't be overruling school boards or, you know, teachers' decisions. Yeah,
parents shouldn't decide what's taught in schools or something like that.
Yeah, the quote was, "I don't think parents should be telling schools what they should teach." And that is sort of, you know, we've talked about these education issues, whether it's school choice, critical race theory, excellence and merit-based admissions. This issue about, you know, Youngkin really grabbed onto this issue in the soundbite because it kind of encompasses all the dissatisfaction that a lot of folks are feeling with the state's education system. You know, the parents first theme is sort of this umbrella that captures everyone from the right wing CRT folks to people who are really worried that like the standards are being lowered in schools and the admissions tests are being removed. And, you know, people are focused more on changing school names and focusing on the curricula. That kind of encompasses this dissatisfaction that doesn't just live on the right, but it also lives in the center and even a little bit on the center left. So that's been the only ad in the last few days that you'll see on TV from Youngkin. And they're pretty bullish that the education issue is a sort of a sleeper issue that's caught the Democratic Party by surprise.
So what is McAuliffe pushing back? What is his blitz?
Well, McAuliffe is thinks this is all nonsense. I mean, he said that CRT was sort of a figment of conservatives' imaginations. And he, he's running on the traditional Democratic message on education, the teachers union type theme message, teacher pay going up, get more pre-K, diversify the state's education workforce. The stuff that you would be hearing from any Democrat in any election, you know, whether it's now or 20 years ago, right? And I think Youngkin has sort of tapped into what's changed in the last couple of years. And again, this is a big test. I wrote a column about this today. This is sort of a big test of the Republican cultural messaging, right? I mean, it's Trumpism without Trump, but I think it's not just right wingers that are worried about the state's education system. There are a lot of, I have these conversations in my own as a Virginian, have these conversations with a lot of Democrats that are really worried about standards, really worried about where the curriculum is going in these schools. And I think he's tapped into something that he thinks is a political winner.
This will be very, very revealing because Youngkin has been, you know, trying to walk that tightrope. So on the issue of, you know, the election big lie, you know, he will say things like, we need to audit the voting machines and stuff, you know, throws enough red meat to the Trumpian base. But we'll see whether or not that's salient, because if he can pull this off, what that says is that Republicans, at least in some of these in some areas of the country, will be able to get away with going along with the Trump election narrative as long as they hit the other cultural issues. That's really what you're saying here, is that while Democrats and progressives have been focusing on January 6th and the big lie, Youngkin can sort of wink, wink, wink about the fraudits and things like that. But the real push is going to be on these other cultural issues, including education.
Voters are not holding the whole Republican Party responsible for the acts of Trump. The problem for Republicans is their voters want that stuff. So if you have sort of a unicorn where you get, you know, if it's a Glenn Youngkin in Virginia or in New Hampshire, it looks like the governor, Chris Sununu, is leaning towards the Senate race. And he's also walked that tightrope pretty effectively. So it's actually kind of interesting that in some of the bluer states that are battlegrounds, Republicans have had more success because they don't have to deal with the Trump factor quite as much in their own primaries or nominating processes. It's the redder states where they may lose because they just go so far to the crazy that no candidate can win, even in a good state like
this. I think this is an important point, because Glenn Youngkin was not the most Trumpy candidate in that primary, but in other areas of the country, well, like Georgia, where they appear serious about nominating Herschel freaking Walker to the United States Senate, or other candidates who might be, so we say, really problematic in a general election. In Virginia, you put up, what did you say, the Mitt Romney in a Trump world.
Yeah. I mean, there are still, I mean, a lot of them are kind of keeping their heads down. A lot of them are adjusting to this new Trumpian controlled universe. But the majority of Republicans in Congress, and we've talked about this before on the show, keep their, you know, bite their tongues, but ultimately don't see eye to eye with anything these Trumpists see. So like Mike Gallagher is a good example in Wisconsin.
Yep, perfect.
He was a Cheney supporter for a while until he turned on her. But, you know, very reasonable, smart, policy-oriented guy who, if Ron Johnson retired, would likely run for the Senate. The question is for Republicans, if you're an anti-Trump Republican, is he someone you can get behind, or is the whole party corrupted at this point?
That's the big question. Josh Krashauer, thank you so much for coming back on the podcast. You can read Josh's stuff at the National Journal, his column Against the Grain. Good having you back, Josh.
Thanks, Charlie.
And thank you all for listening to today's Bulwark podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. I'm going to be off tomorrow because I'm going to be taking a red eye from LA back to the Midwest, but we will be back here on Friday, and sitting in for me tomorrow on the podcast, our good friend and colleague Amanda Carpenter. Have a great day.